Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, your home for deer hunting news, stories, and strategies. And now, your host, Mark Kenyon.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast. I'm your host, Mark Kenyon, and this is episode number 77. Today in the show, we're joined by Jeff Sturgis, and we're talking about cold fronts, properly timing hunts, and killing pre-rut and rutting bucks. All right, welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, brought to you by Sitka Gear. Now today we've got a great episode, and the goal today is to prime and prepare you for the upcoming pre-rut and rutting action that's just days away. I mean, folks, things are about to get crazy, and I'm pumped, and Dan's pumped, and if you've got any blood running through your vein, I can't talk.
How crazy is it going to get, first of all? That's what I want to know.
I mean, it's going to get crazy. I can't even talk.
Man.
I can't even talk.
Yeah.
But what I was trying to say, Dan, is that if anyone out there listening, if they've got blood in their veins, if they've got some oxygen in their lungs, I'm thinking they're pretty pumped up right now, too. So if that is the case, and I think it's the case for you and me, that's for sure, our guest is going to be someone that we want to listen to because we've got Jeff Sturgis on the show. And he's going to fill us in on some great ideas for taking advantage of the weather at this time of year. And he's going to talk to us about how he approaches the pre-rut and rutting timeframes, which is a topic that he actually wrote about in the upcoming November issue of Outdoor Life. And he's really an expert on this. So if you're not familiar with Jeff, he is an outdoor writer, author, and whitetail habitat consultant. And, you know, over the past 5 years or so, he's been one of the greatest influences on me as a deer hunter. So all that being said, if you haven't heard from Jeff before, you should go back and listen to episode number 11 at some point because we did have him on already. But in that conversation, we talked about habitat and food plots. But today we're talking hunting. But of course, before we get Jeff on the line, Dan, you and me do have some catching up to do.
Right. And I don't know. I know this is off topic, what I'm going to tell you right now. And I probably should have told you this before we got on the air. But
Can I tell you something?
Yeah.
I just got an email from someone last week who said that our pre-guest BS sessions are lame and unrelated to the topics that we're supposed to be talking about.
Okay. Well, so give me then, that guy's address and I'll go have a personal conversation with him.
So proceed with what you're about to say because I'm sure this is going to be right up that guy's alley.
Right. So, you know when you make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and you know you drop just like you're taking a bite out of it and you know you drop a little piece of jelly somewhere and you can't find it.
Is this related to another dream?
No, this just happened because I just finished. The reason why I was late to log in was because I made a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So I dropped this little piece of jelly and now I can't find it. So it's probably in the carpet somewhere, which will just be another reason for my wife to get mad at me.
Well, that's not good. But
anyway, it's deer hunting season.
Tell me more about this sandwich. Is it crunchy or creamy peanut butter?
It was creamy. And it was towards the end of the loaf. So I had to use one regular piece and one heel, which to be honest, is like my favorite. I love using the heels on a sandwich.
I'm still stuck on the creamy peanut butter thing. I have a hard time dealing with creamy peanut butter people.
Really? So you're I don't know. I guess I'm far enough into my relationship where I just let my wife make all the difficult decisions. So she likes creamy. That means I like creamy.
I get it. You know what I mean? This is you not having any spine anymore and dealing with crappy peanut butter.
You're damn right. Because it avoids conflict. And the more conflict I can avoid means the more pulling power I have towards hunting season.
It all comes back to that, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. But you're right. Guess what's coming up?
The freaking rut.
The Rut Express is coming.
I'm stoked.
I'm dude, I have oxygen in my lungs and I have blood in my veins. And I feel like I should just be like, I feel like heavy metal is going off in my head all the time now.
For me, it's not heavy metal. It's like techno.
Techno.
I'm jamming. I'm fist pumping. And I've got like strobe lights going off.
Right. Flat billed hats.
You know me.
Yep. Cool.
So.
And unrelatable to the topic.
Exactly. But really, we do have some updates before we talk to Jeff.
That's right.
That are related to deer hunting because at least I know you were busy doing your wedding crap that you always like to do, but I was hunting in Iowa this past weekend.
Let me just get mine out of the way first, okay?
Let's do it.
All right. Friday, right? All day at work, super pumped to get out, left 2 hours early, drove down to my main hunting spot, right? Go all the way back to the end of the property, and I haven't hunted this piece all season long. The loggers are done. I get out of my truck. I start getting ready, and what do I hear? Chainsaws. So I walk closer to this field edge where I was kind of thinking I was going to cross this field and go into this bedding area. And that is where they were chainsawing. So the farmer has let, I think, 3 or 4 different guys come in, and of all the treetops that were left from the loggers, she's given these guys permission to cut wood and take this wood out.
Not ideal for you.
Nope, not ideal for me. So I go to my backup plan, right? Friday night, backup plan. You know, the corn has not been harvested out of this field where, you know, I get a lot of early season movement. And there's a giant buffer strip that, you know, in the summertime and early fall and early October is a great bedding area for these deer. And sure enough, there were no deer there. So I didn't see one deer from the week, the entire weekend, because the next morning I said, okay, I'm going to lay off this property. I'm going to save it. And I have this grand idea where I'm going into a fresh sit on Sunday, right? So Sunday comes and I go, all right, I'm hunting. And my wife goes, well, I have a lot of orders to do. I'd really appreciate it if you could, you know, come home instead of hunt. Yeah. So I did a huge eye roll and really thought about, okay, what am I going to do? So I decided, you know what? I'm just going to go home. Today at work, I sent my wife the itinerary for the rest of the year. I said, I'm going to be hunting this day, this day, this day, this day, this day, taking off this day. I'll be back in time to have the kids trick or treat, my brother's wedding. So I am going to hunt the entire second week of November.
That's good.
And 2 days the first week. So
less good, but
it's not ideal, but it's more than I believe other women would give their husbands.
Fair enough. Take what you can get.
Yep. And Mark's turn.
Mark's turn. Mark's turn. You know, I was pumped up because that cold front hit in Iowa, so I was heading to Iowa.
Yep.
And I'll try to make this quick, but I did a lot of thinking trying to decide, okay, where am I going to hunt that first night when I get there? Because again, as we talked about, I've never hunted this property before. I've only scouted it for like an hour, 2 hours when I got to walk through it the day after I got permission on it. And then I've just looked at maps and stuff. So I drove up Thursday night, camped Thursday night, woke up Friday morning, drove to the other property, my kind of tier 2 property, and was going to check that trail camera and maybe hang another camera and scout a little bit and just get a feel for it, see if it was worth checking out more. Well, first, the camera I had out there malfunctioned, so it just took a bunch of random pictures all summer.
Buzzkill.
And then number 2, while I'm checking those pictures, tons of people are coming in and out of the property, and one of them was a pickup truck with a bunch of muzzleloader hunters who were there for the early muzzleloader season. They said, oh, yeah, we're going to be walking all over the place. We're going to be hunting here this weekend, blah, blah. So I was like, all right, well, that's not going to be too good for me. I'll move on to option number two, which was where I really thought I'd be focusing anyways. So headed to the other property I have permission on, and the day before, I've been kind of brainstorming with my buddy Corey, who you know, and we've been debating all sorts of different ideas about where would be the best place to sit that first night and that weekend, really, because my goal with this trip last weekend was, you know, mainly to learn some things. I'm essentially preparing for my big rut trip, so I wanted to be able to observe areas, hopefully see a lot of deer activity, and then check those trail cameras, and then finally maybe do a little more scouting, hang some stands, hang some trail cameras, so that everything's kind of as prepared as best as possible for my big trip. So that said, I ended up deciding on a spot where I could hunt that ended up being pretty good, not only from an observation standpoint, but I also thought from a hunting standpoint, because this cold front was hitting, so I thought, okay, there's definitely going to be a lot of deer movement. So I found what I thought was a really good-looking transition area from what I thought was probably one of the best bedding areas on this farm to what I thought would be a prime food source. And in between was this transition area that I could get to easily and safely with that wind direction, and there was a pond there too. So I thought, hey, I got in between food and bedding, I got a pond, I got a great wind, I got great view, this could be pretty good. And it was. That first night, I saw tons of deer, and it ended up being a lot better than I even thought. Like, the tree I picked ended up being like, I wouldn't, having known what I know now, I would not move the tree I picked initially. It is exactly where every deer coming out of these bedding areas all funnel past. It's way better of a job picking a tree than I usually do. So tons of does piling out. They all funnel past this tree. Check out this pond. Some little bucks, more does, little bucks. And then right at like just before last light, I look to my left and there's just this massive white frame. And it was one of those just instant shooter, like instant holy crap type of buck.
Yeah.
And the issue, though, was that it was getting really close to dark. And I looked at him and I looked around me. I'm like, man, I've got like less than 5 minutes for him to close this distance. And if he doesn't, I'm not going to be able to get a shot. He's like 80 yards now. And so I'm just sitting there like praying, please hurry up and get over here. Unfortunately, he just slowly was picking his way through this tall grass. He'd stop, look around, nibble, look around at other deer, and just slowly meander in his way. And I tried to grunt once just as I was like kind of a Hail Mary, like maybe I could speed him up, just do a little light grunt. Just, you know, didn't want to do anything crazy, but thought I'd give it a shot. And he didn't really seem to give much about it. So he just kind of slowly moved through. It's getting darker and darker. Shooting light passes. I know, okay, it's done now. He got into some brush, and then another couple minutes later, all of a sudden, he pops out of the brush, and he's right in front of me, 20 yards broadside, and there's no way I can shoot him, but I can see him clear as day through my binoculars at 20 yards right there. So I just got to watch just like big-bodied, mature, huge 8-pointer. Just a I know you see a lot of big 8-pointers there living in hunting in Iowa, but for me, this is the biggest 8 I've ever seen. Yeah. I think he was probably mid-140s.
Just that's a big 8-pointer.
Big frame. So that was sweet. I was stoked. I was just pumped up on adrenaline the rest of the night. And I ended up having to wait like almost an hour after dark because he hung around for so long. He just slowly worked past me and then went around me. But I watched him for probably 35 minutes, maybe longer. Until he finally took off into the timber, walked in the timber and away, and I was able to sneak out. So I was pretty excited, but the next day I hunted the morning and the evening, and I didn't
what?
End up...
Wait, what?
Yeah, I hunted a morning.
You hunted a morning?
Yep, I did.
Oh, man.
I know, it's against my religion, but... I thought, you know, I've got limited sits here, and it's not like I'm going to overpressure this, because this is one sit of an entire month that I've been there, and that huge cold front came through. It was in the 20s, and thought, hey, it's worth a shot. And, you know, the more I talk to people in some of these states like Iowa, it's a lot different than where I hunt primarily in Michigan and Ohio. You can get away with a little more, and so I thought, hey, I'll give it a shot. So I did. Still saw a decent number of deer, just not the big boy again. And the evening sit was looking good. I ended up hunting the same place I did the first night. Was hoping that big guy would come back through. Again, saw a bunch of does and little bucks, but this time, like 10, 15 minutes before last light, a bunch of kids on four-wheelers and dirt bikes drove around all of the cornfields all around me, screaming and driving and racing around, scared every single deer away. So that
Did
was...
you try to shoot those kids?
You know, I didn't think that'd be best since I think they were the owner's kids, okay. And that might not be so good for my relationship there. So
that's a good idea.
Yeah, so I let them go. Passed.
You passed.
Passed on those. And then the next day, I decided just to do a little work on the farm, just a little prep work. So at midday, I snuck into a couple spots, did a little speed scouting, hung a bunch of trail cameras, hung a stand, got out of there and headed home. So nice. I'm now ready for the rut, and I'll be back in 10 days.
Nice, nice, nice. Well, it sounds to me like you got a little information from that weekend.
I did. I confirmed where a couple doe bedding areas are, so I feel good about that. I got... you know, a better idea of where other hunters are. I did find another couple tree stands, and one of these tree stands, the guy actually cut an ATV path right in front of my trail camera. And so I have him on camera going in to set the tree stand. I see the tree stand. So I know he went in there in early September, hung the tree stand, but he has not been back to hunt yet. So I'm hoping, fingers crossed, maybe he's just a gun hunter. Yeah. And that was the only sign. Those two tree stands kind of almost next to each other are the only stands that I've seen other than the first two I saw in the summer on the other side of the farm. So hopefully that's not it's not going to be a big issue, but we will see. I checked the camera. Like I said, I got that big 8-pointer on camera, and then I got two other really nice 10-pointers. So they're not going to be competitors in our trail camera contest. So it's basically Ohio bucks versus Iowa bucks that you got. So we're going to have to post that online here soon.
This could be a precursor to the Big Ten National Championship.
You're right. You're how do we not talk about that? Go green.
Go Hawks. Undefeated.
Both of us.
I know.
It's not
we don't play each other this year, but you know.
Now
we could play each other at the national championship.
Well, we could play each other in Big Ten championship.
Yep, that's what I meant. Yep.
Yeah. If we beat Ohio State, and if you got Nebraska still, and I think a couple other teams, but
we have one of the easiest schedules.
You do.
In all of football.
I'd be surprised if you don't. You should win out.
We should, knock on wood.
Yeah, so that's going to be interesting. In Michigan State, you know, we had the craziest ending of a game ever this weekend. I literally was, I let out like a yell when I saw the final result on my phone because I turned it off with 10 seconds left. I'd been following like ESPN's Gamecast on my phone.
Yeah.
And I saw 10 seconds, it was fourth down, and they're in a punt. I was like, ah. I was, you know, I'm a super, 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 super huge fan. So I was pretty upset, but I'm like, all right, I'm going to focus, and I'm just going to kill a buck so I don't feel bad all night. Put my phone away, and then those guys drove their ATVs all around. So then I'm like, I pull up my phone again, and then the final came up, and I was like, what? It was insane. So, yeah, go green, go Hawks, and we are running a little late, and we need to call Jeff now, Dan.
Right now.
So let's stop our John, and let's give Jeff a call. But before we get a hold of Jeff, we do need to pause briefly for a word from our partners at Sitka Gear. And as we do every week, we're hearing from Sitka product category leader Dennis Zuck. And today I asked Dennis about the new camo pattern that Sitka launched this year for whitetail hunters and how that was developed.
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, we here at Sitka, when we look at developing something, we get really specific. And when we developed our original forest pattern, we were as specific as 17 yards in a tree, 20 foot up. You know, so we were looking at that time you get the opportunity to harvest that magnificent, you know, deer. Going back, you know, we thought more about the entire process and thinking about, well, that deer comes in at 80 yards maybe is the first time he could see you, or, you know, that whole engagement process. And coming back around that thought process, thinking about both that micro and macro and the theories that some of the Colonel O'Neill work, we believe by lightening it up, considering more the sky contrast, making sure that, you know, as you're further out, that you're still breaking up really, really well. Not that the other didn't do a great job, but this is just a, you know, amplified version of that. We saw that as an opportunity to just continue to evolve. And I think this new pattern is absolutely an evolution. It looks different because, you know, we consider that micro, macro, and all those in the environments in our consideration, but in two different distances. So, you know, we actually we verticalize a pattern versus horizontalize a pattern, whether I'm going to hunt it from a ground or whether I'm going to hunt it from a tree. You know, so when you start shifting and moving things and orienting the pattern to think about the angle that something's looking at it, it starts to get kind of interesting. And I think that's made these patterns interesting.
So something I've heard you mention before is this micro and macro patterns in the camouflage. And that seems to be a really important thing when it comes to developing a camouflage pattern. But I don't know if a lot of people understand what that means. Can you tell us what micro and macro patterns are and why that's important?
So yeah, absolutely. So the macro is the larger blocks, right? So when you're further away from something, you need these larger blocks to break up and disrupt a pattern. Kind of like, you know, the lines on a tiger, if that makes sense, right? So that's your macro. And as you move closer and I start to see lines and I start to see depth and I start to understand what that object really is, well, that's your macro. That's where the smaller pieces come in. And that's your cheetah in a tree, you know? So that's the really fine texture things that you see and, you know, it looks like part of my environment or it doesn't, if that's what your goal is. But it's combining those two that makes a really effective pattern. So that micro macro philosophy is something we use quite a bit, and as does the military, as does, you know, people who are really trying to put a lot of science behind their development.
So there you have it. Some interesting insight for you to ponder about the science of camouflage. And if you're interested in checking out that new pattern from Sitka or any of their other clothing, visit sitkagear.com. And now it's time to get Jeff on the line. But a quick small apology. We did have some issues with the phone service for Jeff, so the audio is a little bit scratchy at times. We apologize for that, but I think you will enjoy the content of this episode so much that you shouldn't mind. So, as I mentioned, let's give Jeff a call. All right, with us now on the line is Jeff Sturgis. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be back.
Yeah, we are excited to have you back too. And, you know, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, back in the spring of 2014 was the last time we talked to you on the podcast in episode number 11. But most of that was about food plots and habitat work. So today we want to grill you about the other half of your whitetail expertise, which is hunting. And as I talked about with Dan earlier, you know, I've learned a lot from you when it comes to properly timing my hunts. And that's a big focus of what we were hoping to chat with you about today. So I think without beating around the bush, there's a lot of people, me, Dan, and everybody else listening, that are really pumped up to hear from you on this topic. So I think we should just jump into it. And I'm curious. I've read a lot in your books and on your website about properly timing when you hunt and where you hunt. Can you share with us why you talk about that so much? Why you think that that is so important?
Yeah, Ken. It's a real passion of mine because I used to. Now, I live down where I hunted for the last 14 years in southwest Wisconsin, but I used to make the annual trek, sometimes even every 2 weeks. I would drive 7 hours down here to southwest Wisconsin and hunt, sometimes just for a 2-3 day hunt. And what I found was that, you know, we'd be gone for 2 weeks, we'd come back, and the woods were just full of scrapes and rubs, and they weren't there before, and here we're coming down on an 80-degree weekend, and the hunting was really poor, and we could tell we were missing things. And so over the years, it became apparent to me that, you know, I had a business at the time. I was a real estate appraiser, and I had a young family, and so it was really important for me to prioritize my time. And I found that I was better off looking towards certain days that returned a high value for the sit, even if that meant only hunting 1 or 2 days instead of 3 or 4 days. So it was really more about not only prioritizing my time, but also maximizing my opportunity so that when I did go into the woods, I had a much higher likelihood of actually running into a mature buck. Now, I am not a poker player or a card player, but it's no different. I've watched it on TV. That's about it. But a little bit here and there at deer camp. But for the most part, when you're playing poker, you're playing the odds. And so the guys that know the odds inside and out can calculate that when they play their next move or when they need a card, they know exactly what they're looking for. They know what all the cards that they're on the table. They might even be able to read the other people playing so that when they make a decision, it's based on odds. And that's the same that I want to do when I enter the woods. It's not that, you know, that any time isn't a good time to be in the woods. It's just that when I go out to actually hunt and go after a mature buck, I really want to tilt those odds in my favor. So, you know, maximizing time, prioritizing at the same time. You know, there's a lot of times, or even my friends around here, they'll look at a long weekend they have and they'll say, you know, is it better if I hunt on Saturday, Sunday, Monday? Should I take a Friday off or a Monday? And really what they're trying to balance is not only work, but family too. And so it might be that, well, they're better off spending a Saturday morning with their family and maybe hunting Saturday night, Sunday, and then Monday instead of taking Friday on a poor day, forcing on Saturday and Sunday. And, you know, so it's really gives you that opportunity to balance your time a little bit better too.
Yeah. This concept here that you're talking about, and me and Dan have talked about it a lot, and we've talked about it on other podcasts too, but I keep on bringing this up because I think, at least for me personally, and I think for a lot of guys, is probably one of the, if not the most important kind of revelation that's come to me as a deer hunter that has changed how my success has looked is focusing on identifying the high quality sits and having fewer of those, but being more high quality and reducing the number of low quality sits. Like, just like you said, playing the odds, hunt when the odds are highest, stay out and keep the pressure off when the odds are low. And I think that has changed everything for me. And
yeah, that's true. So true.
So with that being the case, then, you're talking about, you know, timing these hunts. And I know that you spend a lot of time, maybe more than anyone I've listened to, kind of micro analyzing some of these things. And I really enjoy that. And I find it really fascinating. We've talked to a couple guys like Mark Drury. We talked to this about a lot. He seems to do a lot of this type of analysis, which we've all really enjoyed hearing from mm-hmm. him. But for you, right, when you're looking at timing these hunts, can you share with us the criteria that you're looking for? And then from there, I want to dive into some of those criteria, the specifics of each, but at the high level, what criteria do you pay attention to when trying to determine what are my high quality sits?
And I'll jump into that in just a second. I just want to back up for just a real brief second here.
Sure.
One of the reasons for determining that high value sit is what I found, the less, less is more and all that. But one of the reasons is because you're placing a lot less pressure on your property. And so if you're only hunting the high value sits, you're not going out and spending sits on high quality stands or high quality potential sits that just aren't there yet. And so you're not educating the does that might be in the area, even a mature buck or two. They're just not used to you sitting in those stands, leaving your scent, coming in by your scent by your tree 3 hours after dark. And so in that way, you're keeping your stands fresh, and a fresh stand is the best stand. And so I found the stands that are average can turn into your best stand on the property just simply because you haven't been over to that little corner yet. And so going forward, when I see these opportunities, coming up, you know, for those high value sits, and I'm looking for, number one, a major temperature drop. Number two, I'm looking for a difference in wind speeds. And so it's not that you can't have a moderate wind and go out and shoot a buck, but to me, it's all about the difference in wind. Say, for example, a drop from 50 to 25 miles an hour is just about as important as a drop from 30 miles to 25 miles an hour. So it's really about that change. And same with the temperature, looking for extreme weather conditions to help set up that that potential great high-quality day. And you're looking for a string of really boring or poor days ahead of time to also set up that high-quality day. So it's almost like up to about 4 or 5 days, as long as you have some poor days in a row, then when a good day presents itself, then it's time to hit the woods and those deer will be ready to experience that good day too.
So are you saying then, like, for example, this past weekend, a huge cold front came through, and the four previous days had an average temperature that was maybe 15 degrees warmer than that high on the day that the cold front came through. So you're looking at a large period of time before the actual cold front.
Yes. Yeah. And it could be even just a day or two that helps to serve to set up that, especially I think the deer and the mature bucks are a lot, you know, that roller coaster is going up and down a lot more during the rut. But especially when you're looking at October 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, and you have those poor days in a row, handling the 15th drops, and there's some heavy winds on the front side of it, and maybe even some pounding rain and thunderstorms. When it calms, the high pressure is rising, and it's those blue skies and cool temperatures, then, man, that those 4 or 5 days of poor weather really serve to set up that day.
So, Jeff, you mentioned temperature drops and a change in wind, but a couple other criteria we hear when it comes to looking at, you know, what are our high value sits. A couple criteria we hear about a lot are the moon and barometric pressure. Do you pay attention to either of those at all?
Yeah, I do. I do the moon, and there's a lot of scientific evidence out there as far as the timing of the rut and when does enter estrus, and a lot of it goes against the moon phase theories as far as, you know, the moon inducing some timing of the rut or the start of the pre-rut. But I do firmly, whether you believe in that or not, I do firmly believe that the moon has a lot to do with feeding timings. And so, for example, deer feed 5 times in a 24-hour period, and if there's a full, bright, rising moon, it sure seems like they feed a lot later in the evening. And so on a full moon evening, you can count on those deer to be, you know, a little bit lower value sit, for example, because the deer just aren't going to come out as early as they would on a dark moon night or a moon night where that moon isn't rising. At least that's what I've experienced. Now, the following morning, though, that's when it really gets interesting for me, because it seems like, you know, kind of imagine those deer feeding 5 times in a 24-hour period. Their big feeding is in the dinner time, in the evening, in the afternoon. And so when those deer are feeding heavy at that time, the next time is a light time, the next time is a little bit heavier. And so there's a little bit of a roller coaster cycle that I think that moon induces. And so what that sets up to me is a late morning time, sometimes noontime feeding. And so I believe, and I've experienced some really high quality mature buck movement during that late morning time when there's a full moon rising. And so I pay attention to the moon for those factors. And then when you get into the barometric pressure, you know, really I don't pay attention to it as much, but I do. And the reason for that is I'm looking for that big cold front to come through, clearing skies, cool conditions, and when you have those conditions, you have a high barometric pressure. So it's not that I'm looking at, you know, looking for that barometric pressure as much as I'm looking at the conditions, and if those conditions are there, then the high barometric pressure is there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so the things you're looking for, those days after the cold front, naturally those tend to be those high-pressure days. So,
yes, definitely.
So... Yep. So then here's the next thing I'm curious about, because, right, I think we hear about this type of thing, paying attention to cold fronts, looking for those changes in wind speed, like it seems like you like when it calms down a little bit, and the high pressure days. We hear about a lot of these things, but sometimes it's hard to understand how to actually take that and put it into play. So something I've seen you do the last couple of weeks is you're putting out this weekly forecast where you talk about what the weather is going to look like in the coming week or 2 weeks. And then which of those days coming up are high value sits and what that means for you as a hunter. Could you possibly walk us through as best as you can remember right now, what that looks like for the coming days here? As kind of an example. And for context, this podcast will be going live on this Thursday. So maybe if you remember what the forecast looks, could you talk to us about what you're looking at with this upcoming weather and how you implement some of the things that we've just talked about?
Yes. Yeah. And I have that weather forecast burned in my head pretty well. But this time I pulled up for La Crosse, Wisconsin. Last time I pulled up Chicago, I was actually thinking about flipping over to the Detroit area or Lansing or Ann Arbor next week.
I like
but
that.
Regardless, so that'll be coming your way anyway.
Perfect.
But, The big thing with this week is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we had 3 days in the low 70s to mid 70s, at least around here in this area. And really, across the same general line, moving east and west, there's not that much difference. There's going to be a lag time of about a day, I would say, from here in lower Michigan, and then another day over to northern Pennsylvania and New York. But really, you know, things happening, for the most part, the weather's moving west to east or west to northeast. So that being said, this week we had those 3 warmer days, and then here we have about a 10-degree drop on Thursday. And so those 3 warm days, to me, really helped set up that Thursday drop. And you could say, you know, if it was 4 or 5 days of poor weather or warm weather, if it was a, you know, if you had a monster storm moving through on Wednesday, that might make a really big difference, but still a pretty quality, a high-quality day.
And especially that's going to be the 22nd of October. And that happens to be the date that I've shot a couple really nice bucks, 5 and 6 year old bucks, had a really nice opportunity on another, got a nice buck on the 20th, on the 27th, another 5, 6 year old. So we're starting to get into that time where I'm really getting pumped. And I think I talked to you about that this week too, Mark. You know, it's a big bucks on cam and on the cameras, and it's getting exciting. Then on Friday, what's really cool is, so Thursday showing a, let's say a low of 39 and a high of 60. Let's say on Wednesday it was a high of 71, so there's 11 degree temperature drop. I believe the morning temperature, now it's, when you look at a weather forecast, and you know maybe some of the listeners don't realize this, but when you see the low for Thursday, that's actually Friday morning's temperature. And so it's a little deceiving because if you look at Wednesday, the low was 49, that's actually Thursday morning. So Friday morning has a forecasted low of actually 39. And so 10-degree temperature drop from morning to morning, I'm looking for that, from daytime highs to daytime high. And in some areas, they're actually calling for a little bit of rain or precipitation, maybe some higher winds on Wednesday to Thursday. Even looking into Chicago, I think the high-quality days of Friday there, where that will help to actually enhance the value of that day. And going forward, I think there's a little bit of moisture on that Friday-Saturday time, and another little bit of drop on Sunday. And so I'm looking at, like, if I was planning out this week, you know, I'd really want to make a priority of hunting this Thursday, Friday, because of the first couple days after the front, there's good quality temperature drops, a little bit of weather to serve to set that up. And then there's a little bit of a bump where you have some, a little bit of a warmer day, some inclement weather, rain, and then clearing and high pressure on Sunday. So if I'm planning my sits, I might spend Saturday with family. It looks like Friday night's going to be pretty wet. Not to say that you couldn't shoot a mature buck in the rain, certainly, but if I'm planning my sits and I have 4 or 5 that I really want to get out, I'm actually planning Friday or Thursday morning, Thursday night, Friday morning, and then I'll sit on Sunday as well. So, and then looking ahead, and this is you know looking out a week and a half. There's a really nice drop. I think it's next Saturday or Sunday, where you have pretty steady weather. It looks like next week, and then a major drop around Halloween. So it's still a little ways out. The window of air is probably really high, probably 10%, 15% accuracy rating. But at the same time, I'm really looking forward to that next drop right around Halloween, which is prime time in the northern part of the Midwest.
Yeah, absolutely. That's going to be a great time to be in the tree. Now, looking though at this most kind of upcoming weekend, so you talked about that cold front hitting today, the day that this podcast is going live is Thursday. So that cold front's hitting Thursday. You said Thursday, Friday could be good sits, and then maybe again Sunday. This time of year, the 24th, 25th, 26th, give or take around this part of the year in October, how are you approaching those hunts at this time to take advantage of this good condition, these good conditions? Where are you hunting? What are you thinking about when choosing those stand sites?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm looking at total pre-rut hunting. And what I mean by that is really the bucks to me are not moving that far. And I have to excuse me if this is a poor example or a crash example, but it'd be like there's 30 girls in a nightclub bar or whatever, and there's 10 guys going in, and that's a time where it's pretty easy to meet a girl. And that's to me.
Unless you're Dan, he struggles.
That's funny you say that because I used the same analogy a while ago.
That's funny. Yeah, I used that with a client, and he said I don't see anything wrong with that example. But anyways, it's kind of like that for the pre-rut. You know, these big boys already have their fall range established. They have where they want to eat, where they want to stay during the day, their bedding areas, and they have some does nearby. And it's not that they have to have those does, just the way it works. The does are right next to that high-quality food, good cover, and then those bucks aren't far behind them. So they're already established, and when one of those does starts to get a little ruddy, then it's those bucks, you can pick up on that. There's a lot of does that will start coming into heat. And those first few does are pretty easy for them to find. And they don't really need to move around too much. And so At the same time, right before that happens, they're going to become more active. And I know just in the last 3 days, I've had a lot of scrapes pop up in and around the properties where I hunt, and that's not even going in the woods much. That's just on the exterior edges. So what I'm looking at is, for one, those bucks aren't going to move a long ways, so I'm not going to sit all day. I just don't think there's a lot of value in sitting here in the middle of the day unless you have to get into an area that you can't get out until after dark. So I'm placing a high priority in the morning near bedding areas. So I'm trying to get within 100 to 150 yards of a mature buck's bedding area, knowing that his range might expand from an acre to 10 to 15 acres during the morning, especially when there's cooler temperatures. At the same time in the evening, if I sit in that bedding area, then it's going to be a pretty poor hunt the closer it gets to dark, because that buck is then turning his attention towards the evening food sources, the social areas where all the does and the doe family groups are moving in, the other bucks, and he wants to leave that bedding area and go to that food source. So if I'm still in that bedding area, then the closer it gets to dark, the less chance that I have seen a buck. So I find it best to prioritize my sits and increase that value by sitting in a morning area that relates to a bedding area and then an evening area that relates to a food source. Doesn't necessarily mean I'm sitting in the bedding area or in the food source, but I'm pretty close.
So how?
So that's more the pre-rut.
So how are you choosing? You know, okay, again, we're talking about how we're prioritizing, you know, different days. We've prioritized days, but then how do you prioritize a certain bedding area or a certain food source? Because I'm sure, you know, you're looking at your farm and you have done something to know, okay, I think there's bedding here, I think there's food here. But then the next question that naturally people are thinking through is, okay, I know I want to be by a bedding area in the morning, or I know I want to be by a good food source. Then they start saying, okay, which one? And so I think we've talked about trail cameras, we talk about scouting, we talk about sightings. Yeah. What of all those, if any, or anything else, are you using to then choose the specific food source you're hunting in the evening?
Well, I do love my trail cameras. And for one, it shows me if there's mature bucks on the property or not. It shows me when they come on the property, when they don't. It shows me if they're coming during the day or at night. But at the same time, the direction they're coming from should give me some clue as to what bedding area they're choosing to stay at during the day. And so if I knew that a monster buck was hanging back out in this corner in a bedding area, then that would be my priority stand location, where I'd want to go back into the edge of that bedding area, walk in the opposite direction from the food. So in the morning when I'm walking in the dark, I'm not going through the food source. I'm coming in from the exact opposite way, thinking that that buck is somewhere between that food and his bedding. He might already be in his bedding, but this time of year there's a lot of social activity taking place in the morning. They're making rub scrapes, chasing does. And so I have a lot more of a likelihood of sneaking into the backside of a bedding area, waiting for a buck to come back to me at this time of the year than I'd do October 10th, for example, or maybe even October 15th. And so what I'm also doing is there's a pretty good value sit in the evening too. And so I'm looking at, if I'm gonna sit three times and I'm going to, say, hunt two mornings and one evening, where can I sit in the morning that I'm not potentially ruining that evening sit if I happen to bump a deer and vice versa? So I'm really thinking about my next two to three sits out and making sure that deer are moving from point A to point B, and then they're also moving from point C to point B, and I'm not getting into both those lines or one of those lines and destroying it for that evening hunt. I'm saving another line of movement for, you know, the next morning or the next evening, and I'm trying to prioritize my sits that way so that I can maintain a high value and a fresh stand with each sit. I also, in each area, most of my really high-quality areas that I love to really focus on, I'll usually have two to three complementary stands. And so one area I can think of in particular, I just can't wait to hunt this weekend, it'll be the first set, it's a triangle of stands. The one I can hunt with southerly winds in the evening, the other one I can hunt with northerly winds all day, either morning or evening, and the other one has to be southwesterly winds to westerly winds in the morning. And so it gives me a great complement of stands I can hunt just about any wind condition, morning, evening, midday, it doesn't really matter. If I know there's a big buck up there, which there always is, then I can go into one of those stands and get a high-quality sit. But after I sit in there that one time, I'll probably skip over and hunt another set, for the next sit or, you know, the following morning.
So are you ever looking at an area, in a particular stand, and in setting a morning and an evening, or an evening and a morning, to try to catch movement coming back and forth if, in fact, the wind is the same?
Yeah, and there's a lot of times where, you know, when we're out in the hill country, you can cheat the wind a lot, which is different than the flatland. I mean, I lived in Michigan for 42 years, so it's pretty flat there compared to, you know, out here. But that being said, if you can get away with hunting both those mornings, there's times where, let's say the total movement from where I think a buck bedding is to where I think he's really generally spending his evening and nighttime hours, let's say it's 400 yards long, that movement, or 300 yards. Well, I might come in the opposite direction, get a good morning hunt, and then leave that same way. And then I'll flip around in the afternoon for a nice 3 to 4 hour sit, actually walk in through the food source and get into my stand location and let my wind blow into a safe way. And so in that way, I'm hunting both ends of the movement. And if I feel that I got in non-invasively in the morning, I didn't hear any spooks, I didn't hear anything blowing at me while I was on stand, and I thought I got away with a good clean sit, I will certainly try that at times too.
Are all your stands pre-hung then, or do you set up a lot of stands throughout the year?
Yeah, most of my stands are pre-hung. Okay. Now, when we go down to Ohio and hunt on public land, we have a few that we set a couple weeks ago, but at the same time, we have a lot of trees that we've marked for climbers. And I do use climbers occasionally around here. I like actually the comfort of a climber. I like the portability. I do not like the noise walking in with it. You know, up here it already takes me 50 minutes to get to some of my stands walking up 400 feet in elevation. So to put a climber on my back along with the extra weight I have on my front, then it gets me pretty tired out by the time I'm up there. So I try to have those pre-hung stands cleaned out and ready to go, and then I'll use a climber when I need that flexibility.
You mentioned that when you're setting up for those morning sits at this time of year, you like to be, I think you'd said, like 100 to 150 yards from where you think that bedding area is, trying to be kind of close into there. On the flip side, in the evening, are you relating more to, I know you mentioned that you're relating more to the food source, but I'm just curious about the relativity of being near that food source. Are you hunting right on the food, or do you like to still usually try to stay pretty far off it? I know from some of the stuff I've read from you, you've talked a lot about the lines of movement and placing mm-hmm. yourself on that, but I'd love to hear a little more about that and you know, and if that factors into your distance from food or distance from the prime food, things like that.
Well, one of the things, I'm kind of looking at absolutes too, and one of those things is that absolute is where is the staging area. So staging area to me is a really thick area, brushy area, high stem count density of regeneration, conifers, grasses, briars, kind of that mix where that last step of safety that a deer will go through from its secure bedding, secure travel corridor, gets to that edge in that staging area, and when it pops out of there, it's really heading towards food. And so a lot of times, because of the stem density and the proximity to the food, those areas also become doe family group bedding areas. And so what I'm trying to do is really protect that. So I'm thinking of a spot that I hunted in the evening. It was in 2011, shot a real nice 5-6-year-old buck, beautiful buck on October 22nd. And I was able to position myself. There was bedding areas on benches down below the flat that I was on. And then there was a staging area that was probably about 70 to 80 yards from where my stand location was. And so if you can kind of imagine, I'm coming into this stand location to my left, and approximately within 75 to 150 yards, there's high-quality bedding. To my right, about 70 to 80 yards, there's a staging area with a high likelihood that there were some doe family groups bedding. And then about 30 yards out in the grass from there was the start of one of our food plots. That was that food plot, the deer could go in either direction for 550 yards one way or 400 yards in the other. And what I like about not having a big circular food plot at that point is once a deer entered that food source in the evening, it really stretched them out. So more deer would move, more deer. Those deer are pulled out in the middle of the fields, away from the field edge. And that, to me, helps more deer cycle through, too. So in that case, I actually shot that buck with maybe 45 minutes to go before dark as he was cruising between that staging area and the bedding area. And it was kind of a dead area. Almost a secure travel, but more of a travel corridor on benches and funnels than actually coming into, you know, I was basically coming in between doe bedding and buck bedding on a more of an open flat. and the doe bedding be in the staging area.
Now, I know you're enjoying this conversation with Jeff, but before we get to my next question, we need to pause briefly for a word from our sponsors of this podcast episode, Lacrosse Boots. And today, we're going to get a little bit of an education, as we have Ryan Cade, a former product developer for Lacrosse, explaining exactly what we whitetail hunters should be thinking about when choosing a new pair of boots.
Yeah, so, you know, the first thing you want to think about, obviously, is the season. If you're hunting the early season or you're hunting in that November or late season time frame, you know, insulation is a huge factor. The type of boot you're looking for as far as the warmth factor. So, you know, early season, it's great to look at boots that don't have a lot going on from an insulation perspective, just so you don't get too sweaty. You know, and keep yourself as comfortable as you can. So insulation is a big deal as you look to try to gear up on the footwear end of things. The other thing, you know, that I like to really point people in a direction with is how much scent control is important to you as a hunter. Obviously, all of us really want to hunt the wind to start first and foremost. But outside of that, if you're really looking for something that has kind of maximum scent control, you want to look for a boot that has a lot of rubber all the way from, you know, from the bottom of the outsole all the way up to through the upper, because rubber in itself is just naturally scent suppressing. So it doesn't pick up scent and carry it with you as you move from your vehicle to the stand or to the blind or whatever. So, you know, as you're thinking about boots, if scent control is important, you know, more rubber is better from that aspect of it. If it's not, if you want something that's a little bit more breathable or a little lighter, easier to roll down, there are options out there for many different brands that you can just get some neoprene in the upper from that aspect of things. So scent control obviously is important.
So there you go. Proper insulation and scent control are definitely two things to keep in mind when choosing the right boot for you. And if you are looking for new boots, you might want to consider a couple options from Lacrosse, such as the Alpha Burley Pro or the 4x Alpha, which have that full rubber, very scent-free construction, or the Arrowheads, which are part rubber and part neoprene, which I'm a big fan of because of their ridiculous level of comfort. So if you're interested in learning more about Lacrosse or any of these boots, visit lacrossefootwear.com. And now, let's get back to the show. So something you said there when you're talking about, you know, the benches, I think, beneath you, where that bedding was, and you were up a little bit higher on a flat, it just made me think of something that I'm personally, you know, trying to get better at, especially I'm hunting this year in Northeastern Iowa, where it's much more hilly, a lot more topography than I've ever hunted in before. And something I'm still trying to get better at is understanding how to handle the wind in those situations. Because, you know, as I'm sure both you and Dan have experienced in Iowa and other places, Wisconsin, you know, things like the thermals and the way that the topography adjusts or manipulates wind can make it really tricky to know exactly how to play the wind given those conditions. Can you talk a little bit about how you factor those types of things into making a decision about how to handle the wind? How do you see the wind and that topography kind of influencing each other?
Well, the great thing about the wind in hill country in the morning is that as the temperatures are increasing, the thermals are rising. And so typically, if you're above the deer, you're fine. So that's kind of a general rule. I've been able to sit into some pretty good bedding areas to where there's no way I could go in there in the afternoon because the deer would see me. But the deer are below me, and then I can get in above them. And with those thermals rising, even if that wind, we've had some great stands where literally the wind, you're staring at a rock face to the west. The wind is coming out of the west. So if you're up high on that rock face 100 feet above, the wind would be right in your face. But down below in the morning, that wind is actually circling. And so we're facing the rock face. The wind is actually hitting us on our back coming from the east down below because it's rising back up against that rock face. We learned that the hard way coming out and starting in 2002 where, you know, we think we're watching this great bench in front of us. We're almost at eye level. And then a deer come through and we can feel that wind on our back, even though the wind's forecasted west, it's just blowing right back up at that bench. So we learned pretty quickly, you know, to move our stand on the bench and consequently, I think in that stand, we ended up shooting 13, 14 bucks, averaging 4 years old over a 12-year period.
Jeez.
And it was, and we were counting on that west wind. And the problem with that is if the point went down, basically pointing northeast to our right when we were facing that bluff, and if the wind was too much out of the north or northwest, the wind would actually whip around that point, and then again, with the same thought that it's tailing upward, it would actually tail up to the southwest. So, you know, it's kind of like if, you know, as far as respect to the wind and how it moves through the hills, it moves a lot like water. If you can kind of imagine a wind slamming into the side of a point, and then there being a real ripple effect and circular effect behind that point, that's basically what happens. On the other hand, when you flip over to the other side of that point, and you're getting clean air from across the hollow, then it's a very, very predictable wind. So on that back side, in the lee side, it can be pretty complicated with the angles that are wind, the wind's coming in at. But as long as you're staying above them in the morning, then you're fine. At the same time, if you try to go in there in the evening, the temperatures really a lot of times are not settling and not reducing until that last hour of light. And so, unfortunately, you might have to get in there 3 hours, 4 hours before to make sure that you, you know, capitalize on some deer movement. So if that wind's not settling till that last hour, it can make make for a really miserable sit if you planned on it settling down in the quote right location, but it didn't do so till the last hour of your sit. So that evening time, what I try to do is, you know, come in on a safe wind, and then knowing that with those thermal settling, you can pretty much count on exactly, for example, which side of the ridge that wind is going to tail down to in the evening. And so you might have the wind falling down to the west behind, or the ridge falling down to the west behind you, and that wind is out of the south blowing from right to left, but as it gets closer to dark, you're going to find that wind tailing down behind you. So you need to consider that, too, in case deer are coming in from behind you. It's almost like that ridge acts as a giant berm. The wind blowing against it parallel, and then it'll drop down into the valley right at dark. So if you're expecting deer to come up from that valley, you might have a great sit for the first 2 hours, but that last hour of light, it might be blowing right at them. So there's a lot of different, I mean, you really can study a topo, and you can kind of plan it and make some sense of where it's going to go, but then you get out there, that's a true test. And when you find cuts and draws and steep ravines, they have a, just like they would funnel water, and suck water into them and move water. It's the same way with the wind too.
Yeah, this is one of those topics that can get my head spinning pretty quick.
Yeah, very much so.
So I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but something you just said there related to these ridge lines, I just want to confirm something with you that I've been sitting thinking about a lot this past weekend. There's everybody kind of has their own take on how deer use the wind. You know, specifically a mature buck, how is a mature buck using the wind in his favor at certain times of the year? And I'm curious because I was sitting there this past weekend in Iowa trying to predict, okay, on November 2nd, how is a buck going to be using this ridgeline? How is a buck going to be using this point? And I'm sitting there trying to think through all these things, and I'm mentally filtering through like what 28 different people have told me and what I've seen and trying to figure out what's the right way to go about this. So can you share with us your opinion, Jeff, on how a mature buck would use a feature like a ridgeline with a crop field on top and a valley down below? How's he using that at this time of year, and how's he using that during the rut and then the wind, I guess? How's he using the wind with that topography at those two times of year?
Well, Matt, that gets my head spinning, too, on that topic, and really opens up a can of worms, too, because here's the thing, too. If the main food source is in the valley versus the top, you know, a lot of people say, well, that buck, I've heard these things where the buck will bed three quarters of the way up the hill or two thirds of the way or whatever it is, but it really depends on where the food's at. So if the food's down below, then he's going to bed up high, because the does are going to bed down below. And then if the food's up high, those does are going to bed around that high quality food source, and then he's going to bed halfway down or maybe even all the way down in the bottom. And so what's interesting is the property we used for 12 years out here, we had really specific mature buck bedding areas, and the bucks, because we had enough of them and there was an old age structure, we had one buck that we feel grew to be 8 years old. We shot a few that were in that 5 to 7 year old range. They had very specific defined bedding areas. And it was interesting because when they were really hopping and they were in those areas and they were moving a lot, it wouldn't matter which way the wind was blowing. They always stayed in that bedding area. They'd always travel from that bedding area to another food source. You could always count on that movement. The trick was having stand locations in place and set to take advantage of that movement regardless of what wind that you were presented with. And so it wasn't more about how is this buck going to move the wind to the, you know, use it to his advantages. How can I actually even hunt in that area and not get busted? And so by looking at it from that standpoint, if you know that buck's on that point, you know he's traveling to the top of that point going to a food source, then which side of the point do I need to be on for the wind? And it really is a question. Let's say he chose to be on the other side. There's not a lot you can do about it if the wind's not in your favor. And so what I found, and this is typical of whitetails anywhere, is they usually do, if they can curl around and approach a food source from the downwind, they will. Same with a bedding area. And so if you're on that downwind edge, I think it tilts the odds in your favor a lot, too, to where if he does want to, because when he's back in his secure cover, I think he feels pretty comfortable to move around with whatever wind, you know, this presented, whether he's moving with the wind, against the wind. But as he's getting closer to a risk area meaning an open food source, maybe even a transition area where he's picked up some hunter scent in the past, I think that's where he starts to curl around a little bit and use the wind to his advantage. And if you're on that downwind edge and you're in that thick line or slightly downwind of it, then you have a great, real high likelihood that you're going to run into that mature buck, and he's going to be on the safe side of the wind as far as you being able to get a good shot at him. I know that probably didn't answer your question directly, I know, but it really, there's a lot of variables that come into play. And it really depends on where the food's at. If it's, you know, you might have, we had a big flat on our last property with a lot of points and hollows. And it was interesting because the food was high on one side, then the buck bedded low. And because it was, you know, low on the other side, then they bedded high. And it really depended, it was determined by how much cover there was and where the does were bedding adjacent to that food and how much room the bucks had to bed behind them. But they would bed in the same spot, it seemed like, every day. You know,
are you ever seeing instances, me and Mark talked a little bit about this last week, but are you ever seeing instances where the deer are coming with the wind?
Yes, I am. And it's really when there's when they really don't have any other choice. But at the same time, that's where they might be coming with the wind out of their bedding area. But then if they can curl around and travel into the wind to get into the food source in the evening or vice versa into the bedding area, then you find them doing that into that. It's almost like they have their stopping points are either the bedding area or the food. And when they get to those stopping points, it seems like that's when they want to curl into the wind and make sure what they're moving into is safe. But, yeah, we've seen them move with the wind. Now, I do like if the wind is a little bit at a slight angle, so they can have the illusion of having the wind in their face and I'm just off to the side in an area that I can blow my wind into safely, then I think that's a really good tactic. I think you're going to see more bucks in that case than not.
This stuff is just endlessly both fascinating and frustrating for me. It's like just always trying to figure it out. And it's like you come to believe one thing, and then the next day you see a deer do something the opposite way, and it squirrels everything up again. Yeah. But man, it makes it fun to try to figure it out. That's for sure.
They're very fun. And that's where, you know, like we were sharing some, I was talking about some buck pictures that I had, and we were sharing the excitement earlier in the week for what's coming ahead. And that's, I mean, I've been doing this 30 years, and it's like Christmas. You know, I can't wait. I'm sure my wife is sick of me talking. And unfortunately, you got to feel for her, too. I mean, she sends out all my books. She has to proofread everything and edit everything. She works for the printer. She's not a hunter. She's went turkey hunting this year. She loves going out. She's been on a couple of the doe retrievals, even some tracking jobs this year. I mean, she had to throw away one of her pairs of sweats because she got it so ripped up and thorned up. Her arms are cut up looking for my son's buck a few weeks ago. So she's forced into this, and this time of year, it's an exciting time, and not being able to figure it out 100% is certainly a lot of the fun.
Yeah. So Let's fast forward a little bit. We've talked a little bit. We've talked about some things that apply to any time of year, but mostly we've been focused on, you know, the next 10 days from now, this pre-rut right. period. But let's get into November. Now we're talking more into the prime of what most of us think about when we consider rutting action. For me, it's those first 2 weeks of November are kind of like my Super Bowl, is how I think a lot of us look at it. To start, can you share with us your opinion on the timing of the rut? I know you alluded to it a little bit when you mentioned there are some theories about the moon. We've talked about a lot of the different theories, but I just want to hear from your take, Jeff. What's your take on what actually causes the trigger? What triggers the actual breeding and the rut?
To me, it's the reduction in light in the sky, in the atmosphere, whatever you want to call it, just the same as the leaves changing. And just like the leaves changing, they can be spurned on the change in the leaves, the color, at least them dropping off the trees a little bit earlier or later because of the frost, because of the temperatures, because of the wind. But basically those colors change at the same time every year, and I believe the deer do too. I was real fortunate to spend a lot of time with John Azoga back in the late 90s, early 2000 period. And he's a nationally known research deer biologist. He probably has the most peer-reviewed articles out of anybody on, you know, studying anything and everything. But he told me long ago, he talked about the breeding period in the UP in Michigan. And I believe, I'm not going to quote him because I can't remember the exact, but I believe it was November 11th, that they found that 80% of the does were bred within a week to 10 days on either side of that. It might even have been a week on either side of it. And they could go back, and they had ultrasounded car-killed does. They had, you know, checked fetuses, and they were able to go back and unborn fawns and basically go back to the breeding date and the date of conception, and they could actually figure out the exact day that fawn was conceived. They charted those, and I don't know if they had 2,000 does fawn combinations, and they were able to see over a 20-year period that there was just no correlation between the moon. Now, that being said, you know, what I find here in southwest Wisconsin is that the pre-rut is in the last 7 to 10 days. The main portion of the rut is in the first 7 to 10 days of November. So last 7 to 10 days for pre-rut in October, and then those first 7 to 10 days in November. Now, when I go down to southern Ohio, and if you stretch that line to southern Indiana, southern Illinois, over into portions of Pennsylvania, maybe even over into Maryland, Delaware, and then over into Kansas, Missouri, that line is about a 10 days later. Could be a week later, could be 2 weeks later. But that pre-rut, instead of starting the 22nd, the 25th of October, 27th, it's going to start more like the 5th, the 2nd, the 1st. They're just a little bit behind the further south you go. But what I find is consistently the same. Now that, you know, Mark, you might be on one property 5 miles away, and I'm over here and I'm seeing tons of rutting activity. You know, I'm seeing rub scrapes and mature bucks flying around. You're not over there, and I think that it just boils down to, if you don't have any mature bucks that are residing and have chosen to call that fall cover that you have their home during that season, then you're not going to see any activity until that peak rut. And so that's why there could be a huge variance just from even a mile apart, where someone has, you know, it's more of a have and have not type situation. But once we get into the pre-rut, that's where the fun begins. But at the same time, that to me is a time of where it's more undefined. You know, the bucks are going to be moving, but are they moving on my land, yours, or, you know, are they around home, or, you know, are there girls running out at the bar and they have to go to the next one? So that's kind of the way I look at that. And
sometimes you got to do it.
So it's, that's, you know, in that respect, that's kind of what it feels like, to where, you know, who knows what's going to happen then. And of course, when you get in the post rut, that's when there's no girls anyways, you know, anywhere. And those old bucks really still have that taste, and they really want to go find one. And they might even get in some aggressive, really bad fights too, because there, those other old dudes are looking around too, and they tend to run into each other, and they're willing to move long distances too at that time. So
here's my.
It's all a bar scene.
Yeah, it is. So what I'm curious about then is, as we get into that time period where you mentioned it becomes a little more undefined, when that pre-rut to rut period starts kicking off and deer start moving a little bit more, chasing the does or looking for the does and stuff like that. At that time frame, your philosophy related to, you know, finding the high value sits and paying attention to the cold fronts and the wind and all that stuff, does that go out the window for you? or are you still paying attention to that and applying it in early November? How does
I'm definitely still applying it, because I look at it like every day during the week is not a good day. You know, it's or not a great day. My lease partner, Carl, he'll drive up from Georgia and he'll hunt 8 days in a row. And we figure there's probably two or three really good days. There's two or three middle value days. And then there's two or three days that he might even just spend 1 or 2 days outside of the woods, letting the stands improve and not overusing stands on a smaller property. And so I'm still riding that roller coaster of the cold fronts. And you'll find the cold fronts are usually coming through every 5 to 10 days. So they're pretty reliable. And of course, if it's just a decent cool day and during the rut, that's certainly better than that same condition in the middle of October. You know, there's definitely a higher value for placing a priority on getting in the woods during the rut. But at the same time, if you can afford to be flexible, then I still do. At the same time, it might be that you can choose 3 weekends in a row to hunt. And so let's say you could choose 2 days on either side of that weekend to hunt. Well, it might be cooler on Monday, Tuesday. Well, then I'd stay out of the woods on Thursday, Friday, switch those vacation days. And so even just looking at, I can only hunt long weekends, even just one day off, you might be better off taking a Monday versus a Friday, just depending on the weather. So even then you can let your weather, you know, let the weather guide you a little bit and really prioritize the value of your sets.
From a pressure standpoint, you go into, I guess, an evening hunt and then a morning hunt in the same stand location, let's say. Do you feel that after those two sits that the tree stand is then bad because the deer have maybe worked their way back? How many times in a stand do you think you can get away with it before it starts going downhill?
Well, you know, a lot of that depends on, a lot of these questions too depend on a lot of other factors, but I'll give a couple examples. Let's say, I know a lot of guys in the Michigan area, for example, they might have a 40-acre parcel. They're really narrowing it down to, they want to go into the middle of the rut. You know, let's say their favorite time to go is on November 5th, November 3rd, November 7th, even if they're choosing a high weather, you know, high value weather day, but they're going to go into their favorite stand in the middle of that 40. They're going to go in an hour before light, maybe 2 hours. They're going to sit and they're not going to move all day. Well, even then, they're still, their downwind scent's going to spook some deer. Because their tree stand is in the middle of the woods, there's a great chance they're going to leave scent in, out, even if they just happen to brush it, you know, against a twig or some grass on the way in and out. So to me, that's a lot more invasive. So the quality and the value of that stand location does not have the staying power, as opposed to, let's say, someone's hunting just a narrow funnel in between a couple of high-quality bedding areas, and you can come in from one way or the other. You're coming through deerless open area to get there. Your scent is always secure on the downwind because maybe it's blown into a pond or a cliff or an open hardwood forest, you know, somewhere, even a pile of spruce or something where it's not holding deer. So it's a pretty safe scent. And in that case, now I would rather skip around and try out different stand locations. But that being said, if you had to, you know, sit in a stand set up like that multiple days in a row, you're a lot better off in that situation than going into the middle of your 40 and taking that all day sit on a more invasive set. So, you know, typically I look at it like, if a stand will sit for a week or two in between sits and you had a pretty non-invasive sit, then it's still a good quality stand. But that being said, I think probably 75-80% of my mature bucks, and I'm even thinking back, you know, up to the top 25 bucks have been shot the first time, and a few on the second time going into the stand. Very few on that third, fourth set.
Do you think that if you spook a buck, let's say going in to an initial sit, or he busts you while you're in the stand, do you think that buck is long gone? Or what's your opinion on if they're coming back until they're back into the swing of things again?
I think there's a big difference whether you're walking into an afternoon set, it's 2 o'clock, it's getting dark at 6, and that big monster you're after, you go over a little bit of a knoll and he's there 30 yards away staring right at you. He's probably not going to be back there for a long time. On the other hand, I had this happen the other morning where I walked in fairly early, and when I went across a slight opening in the woods where a certain 4-year-old buck hangs, now it's a really beautiful 8-point that I've passed up a couple times, he was, I just had this giant buck or giant deer run away. When he's running through the brush, he blew and blew and blew, and then he went down lower, and then he blew again, and it's that deep, just deep blow of an older deer, and my heart kind of sank. I thought, man, which mature buck was that? There was no little deer with it, so it wasn't a pile of does and fawns. It wasn't a doe and fawn all by itself. Sounded big. I even tried to listen for antlers crashing against brush. I couldn't hear it. I have a trail camera there. So I went, and 2 days later, I snuck up in that area. It's by a logging road. It's pretty easy to get in and out, non-invasive. My son and I went up there. Checked that card. Sure enough, when I walked in at 10 after 6 or 5, whatever it was, he was there at like 5:58 in the morning getting his picture taken. So I know that was him. That being said, that evening, he came into that same little area, got his picture taken about a half hour before dark as he was cruising back onto the property. And I think, I went in the dark. I don't think he smelled me. He certainly couldn't see me. He heard me just stepping as quietly as possibly in the sandy trail. And so, in that case, a lot different than going out at 2 in the afternoon and him just looking at me when I walked. And so he came right back, and I've had one mature buck come back after I messed up shooting at him and didn't get him. He came back about 10 days later, and I ended up shooting him in that same spot. But even then, he stopped at about 30 yards and started walking around me. So he remembered that after about 10 days. So
it's pretty interesting stuff to see that, how they can start, well, whether you call it remember or associate an area with danger, whatever it is, how they can. They can learn. That's definitely clear, I think, is that they can learn where danger is definitely. And they learn how to avoid it. Or in some cases, in some cases, they can determine what level of danger there is. So
yes, yeah. And, they have sight, sound, and sense. So I'm not sure which one they place their priority on, but when they smell you, see you, and hear you, that's a really bad thing.
Yeah.
as opposed to just hearing some light steps that they think there's danger. You know, when that buck, the other morning, when he ran and then he stopped, stopped and blew. To me, he really didn't know what was going on, or he would have just been gone. I might not even have heard him. He would have just been gone. He would have just slipped away. So that's something to think about too. Usually they take off if they really feel they're in danger.
Yeah, that's a great point. So in the rut then, let's actually talk about how we're hunting. Let's start mornings, and then let's talk about mornings and evenings separately, and then I'm curious about that midday point too. But I do know you've talked a lot about how much you love morning sits during the rut. Can you tell us about that? Why do you love morning sits during the rut so much? And then where specifically do you like to hunt at that time of the year?
Well, I think it all boils down to temperature. And again, if there's that full moon rising, I think they'll move a little bit later in the morning too. But we're shooting the bulk of our bucks between 2 and 4 hours after first light. We're back in those bedding areas. And if you think about it, you could have a morning where it's 27 degrees at daybreak. It's still in the 30s at noon. It might even rise up to 57 degrees in the afternoon, but it's still relatively cold all morning long. And so when we look back at our trail cam photos, we're finding a lot of our buck pictures are from 55, 57 degrees on down. And so we're not getting a lot of mature bucks during the middle of the day at 70 degrees and 60 degrees and 80 degrees. And so you really see that they do seem to want to move a lot more when it's cool out, whether it's windy or not. And so that's why I like placing that high priority in the morning time. And then in the evening, those temperatures aren't changing until that last hour. I think they're, for the most part, in the middle of the day, a lot of times sitting there. And so that's my time to move to an evening stand. Or if I have an all-day sit, I'll sit it out. But I place a high priority on the morning. Just to me, the hours of opportunity that you have compared to the evening, especially back in those bedding areas where they're cruising all morning long.
So those morning sits, you mentioned bedding areas. Are you hunting the downwind side of a bedding area? Are you right in the bedding area? Are you hunting funnels between? Can I have more detail on that? I'm curious.
Sure. There's one stand in particular I can think of where we're coming into the bottom area, and we're coming into a point, and there's a large bedding area around the corner, around the point, and then there's another one off to the left. So basically we're in between that bedding area. Terrible spot in the evening. I think we shot one mature buck there over all the years. But in the morning, those bucks are down low with the big food sources up high, and they're cruising in between those bedding areas. They don't cruise in the October lull. They're not out there in September. They're not there in the evening because all the deer are focused towards the tops. But in the morning, we're right in between those bedding areas. We're probably, you know, say 70 to 100 yards on one side is a great bedding area that expands for 5 acres. And then over to the other side, we have a series of bedding areas and benches that, that you know, might be a half acre, acre in size. And we're just getting in between those. Now, sometimes with the ridge tops that we have around here, I'm going in and sitting right in the middle of the bedding area. It might be on a point. And once I get there, my wind is safe. I'm trying to come in on the side where I don't expect as much deer, so I'm not laying a scent trail for them to find. But I'm sitting right in the middle of the bedding area with the thermals rising on my side and blowing out towards an open hollow. Not something you can do as much in Michigan or an area that's flat, for example. But a lot of times I'm right on the edge. I'm pretty close, or I'm in between two really high-quality bedding areas. Really, it depends on the situation, but, you know, focusing on those bedding areas. Look at it this way. If you have three bedding areas in a row, instead of sitting on the last one, right on the edge, hoping that, you know, you're kind of playing all your cards for that one bedding area, I'd rather be in the middle one, for example. So I'm in between. I'm getting the movement from possibly three different bedding areas and through that middle one, as opposed to staying all the way on the end. So it's all about creating opportunity. It really depends on the situation, you know, how the bedding areas lay out.
Makes sense. I know you mentioned you'll lots of times hunt a different place in the morning versus the evening. How often do you actually hunt, though, the entire day?
I hunt the entire day. I'm trying to think last year. I might have hunted 7 to 10 all-day sits, but all but two of those were in different stands. So I'll actually just get down and move about, you know, a 5-10 minute walk to a different stand that I might think is better towards evening, or even might even take a half-hour walk to get there. But I might be in the woods all day. But as far as sitting in the same stand, rarely, just because of the fact that if I'm sitting near food, then that morning time might not be that great because they're back in the bedding areas. If I'm staying in the bedding areas all day, then the closer it gets to dark, the value of my sit goes drastically down as those deer are going towards the food or focusing on the food. So when you get in the peak rut and there's more midday movement, then I'm trying to focus on an area, say, downwind of food, possibly between bedding areas. So I'm trying to get an X of deer movement. I'm trying to get movement that might go side to side. I might get movement going back and forth between food and bedding. So I'm kind of in the middle of it all with my scent blowing into a steep ridge or hollow, or maybe off to the one side or the other where I can expect to sit all day, throw my scent into safe areas, maybe even with a changing wind, and then still take advantage of both cruising activity and bedding to food activity or vice versa. So that's the one time where, you know, during that peak rut and a little bit sometimes in the post rut, where I'll take a seat all day, maybe even in the same stand where I think I'm just in that really fantastic cruising area that also relates to food and bedding movement at the same time.
So here's something I've wondered a lot about and had different thoughts on. When you are going to do that switch from the morning to the evening stand, what time of day do you think is the safest to switch stands?
That's a good feel question too, because there's times where I'll even say, well, I'm going to switch about 11 or I'm going to switch about noon. I can remember one time we were hunting during the rut, and it was a 4-day hunt. It was the first 4 days in November. I think it's going back to about 2003. And the temperatures were in the teens in the morning. They got up to the low 30s during the day and sometimes the 20s. We sat dark to dark every day. I think we saw 29 bucks between the two of us, and we didn't see a buck between noon and 1:30. It just happened to be that way, but we see a pretty light period during that. We don't have a lot of pressure. So there's not guys moving and bumping deer. So those deer were getting out at that time. But there's a lot of times where I'm planning on sitting tall, especially during the rut. Like when I go out this weekend, I'll probably sit till 11, maybe noon. But at the same time, it might be that it's 11 o'clock and I haven't seen a deer in 2.5 hours. And I'm a lot more likely to get out then and go switch to another stand just out of sheer boredom at that point, or I just want to change the scenery or something. than actually sticking it out till my designated noon time that I had originally set. On the other hand, I might say I'm going to get out at noon, and then I just had a pretty decent buck go through at 20 to 12. Well, then I probably sit at another hour and just see if there's any other action going on at that time in that area.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, I'd say around 11 or 12, especially during the rut this time of the year, when it was October lull, I was sitting for about 3 hours. I kind of have a 3 hour. I love to sit at least 3 hours in the daylight, whether it's, you know, if I'm getting in there 45 minutes early and then I'm sitting once day breaks for 3 hours, same in the afternoon. And then as it gets more towards the pre-rut and peak rut, I'm sitting a lot longer hours to the point of just the only time I might not be sitting is moving from one stand to the next.
Okay. Well, we...
You know, real quick, Mark, too, you know, I probably run out of time here, but I was just going to mention some of those stands that you're sitting in the bedding area stands in the morning, they can be pretty darn good up till 2 in the afternoon, 1 or something like that. And so if I'm moving to more a pure evening food stand, I might actually sit in that till mid-afternoon just because, you know, that value is going to remain pretty high, and there's a big difference from the stand that I'm going to in value to at that time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So like you guessed, Jeff, we are coming up on time. So Dan, do you have a final question for Jeff before we wrap things up? Anything else in your mind we need to know?
Well, any advice on how to handle the wife?
I think that's funny. I think we already touched on that a little bit. It's kind of about, you know, balancing that. And it goes back to prioritizing your sits, placing a high value on your sits, and knowing that sometimes less is more. If you know, one high quality day can be worth a lot more than, you know, several low qualities or medium quality days. And so it might be that, you know, you have that 3-day weekend. Saturday's going to top out at 82 degrees. There's 35 mile an hour winds. It's just a really poor day. You already took Friday off. So, you know, just say, well, I'm going to hunt on Friday, and then tell your wife, hey, let's do something together on Saturday. Is there anything you want me to do? You know, really, she's going to look at it like, wow, you're taking this time in the middle of the rut, in the middle of the season. But you know that Sunday is a really high-valued day, so you're kind of balancing that where you know you need to be in the stand on Sunday. There's no getting around that. And so I think that's the way. And that approach works with your boss, maybe your workplace, depending on your work situation.
Yeah, great advice. Very, very sound advice. I think all of us can apply that to some degree, that's for sure. Now, here's my final question, Jeff.
Sure.
We've only, like, scratched the very tippy top of the surface when it comes to some of these ideas and these topics. And I know you've written a lot about these things in more detail in your two books and your website and a third upcoming project. Can you tell us where can we go right now to learn more, and what should we be looking forward to here in a couple weeks?
Well, you can visit my website, www.whitetailhabitatsolutions.com. If you can remember my name, Jeff Sturgis, you'll run into me that way online too. At the same time, I have a Facebook page with the same name. It's real active. I try to get all my blogs on there. In the upcoming 2 weeks, I have a release of my third book, and that should be released early to mid-November. The details of that are on my site, but the name of it is Mature Buck Success by Design. The first buck was more the habitat and structure of the hunting plan, even public land hunting, and kind of setting up that whole hunt. The second book was relating to food plots and the design and strategy of food plotting. And then this third buck is purely about scouting, preparing, and harvesting mature bucks, and going over a lot of the details that we talked today about and greatly expanding on.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait for that book. I will definitely be checking out. And to the other things you mentioned, the website and your previous two books, for everyone listening, if you haven't already, you've got to check these out. They are some of the best resources I've found when it comes to hunting mature bucks, to managing a property and improving it. And you can even apply a lot of things, especially in the first book that Jeff talks about. You can apply that even to hunting, you know, someone else's land that you just have permission on, or public land, all the above. They are concepts that, as you saw today in hearing from Jeff, that really can help a lot. So, Jeff, thank you so much for spending this time with us. I know that I'm even more excited now than I was an hour ago, because this is stuff that I can apply and I think might help me kill big deer in Iowa this year.
Well, that sounds great, Mark. It's been great with you and Dan. I always have a great time with you guys, so I appreciate you having me back. And, hey, this is an exciting time of the year, so look forward to what's going on with all of us in the next week, and look forward to hearing about it, Mark.
Absolutely. Well, Dan had to drop off, but I know that he feels the same way. So good luck, Jeff. Keep us posted, and we'll hopefully be talking to you again soon.
That sounds great. Thanks a lot, Mark.
All right. Have a good one, Jeff. So there you go. Another episode of the Wired to Hunt podcast is in the books. And before we sign off, though, a couple quick things. First, a big thank you to our partners who helped make this show possible. So big thank you to Sitka Gear, Trophy Ridge, Bear Archery, Redneck Blinds, Huntera Maps, Ozonix, Carbon Express, Lacrosse Boots, and the Whitetail Institute of North America. Also, with the Super Bowl of the deer hunting season coming up soon, as we've been talking about, it's a great time now to get geared up with some Wired to Hunt swag. So be sure to check out wiredtohunt.com/shop. to check out our hats, shirts, and decals. And FYI, we're going to be having some new trucker hats, flat bills, and hoodies available in just a matter of days. So please help support the show and look good doing it this hunting season by picking up some Wired to Hunt gear. Again, wiredtohunt.com/shop. Thanks in advance for checking that out. Finally, please be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't yet. And if you could leave us a rating or review on iTunes, we'd, of course, really appreciate that as well. So, with all of that said, good luck this coming weekend. Things are going to be exciting. So, get out there, shoot straight. And until next time, stay wired to hunt.
Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase.